This is our last class in this series on taking refuge in the three treasures. Dogen's essay exploring these different meanings of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And we've been through a lot of different versions of these three treasures already. So without going into all the details, there's no one fixed way of looking at Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There's a kind of ultimate one-bodied Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that are all like enlightenment itself in a way. And then there's these manifested versions of them as Shakyamuni Buddha and his sutras and the Sangha practicing with Shakyamuni Buddha, and then there's like Buddha statues, images, and Dharma words that continue in the present day, and symbolic representations of the Sangha, like the robes of the Sangha, still manifesting in the world. And as far as Buddha goes, Bodhidharma, our first ancestor in China, in his bloodstream sermon, or the Kechinyaku Rong, Bodhidharma says, "Beyond this mind, you'll never find another Buddha. To search for enlightenment or nirvana beyond this mind is impossible. The reality of your own self nature, that's what's meant by mind. Your mind is nirvana. You might think you can find a Buddha or enlightenment somewhere beyond the mind, but such a place doesn't exist." And Bodhidharma says, "Trying to find a Buddha or enlightenment is like trying to grab space. Space has a name, but no characteristics or form. It's not something you can pick up or put down. And you certainly can't grab it. Beyond mind, you'll never see a Buddha." So that's one way that Dogen also talks about Buddha, is like your own true awakened nature of mind, Buddha nature. And it seems like over the years, people had all these different ideas about Buddhas, almost like some kind of deity to worship, or Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical founder. But Bodhidharma, in the spirit of Zen, says there's no Buddha other than the nature of your own mind. So this is kind of the classic Zen refuge in Buddha. And following in the spirit, Suzuki Roshi, In a Dharma talk from 1967, said, "To take refuge in Buddha means to become one with Buddha, or to find our true nature, which is not different from Buddha." So our true nature is nature of mind, Buddha nature. And so to take refuge in Buddha, he says, is to become one with Buddha. I don't think we've heard that expression put exactly that way yet in these discussions. So Suzuki Roshi was a great English speaker, actually, yeah, for a Japanese teacher. Yeah. It's amazing. He really came up with some great ways to put things.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to our Zen scholar, George, he says that Trudy Dixon was a great bodhisattva and really, you know, was a great student of Suzuki's. And George says that it's this great combination of Suzuki's heart and Trudy's kind of editing. So the stuff that comes out of the book Zen Mind Beginner's Mind,
yeah, It's a joint project.
Yeah, mm-hmm. not to disparage Suzuki's mm-hmm. English, but George wants to give as much credit to Trudy Dixon as possible.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, she died like minutes after, but like before the book was published. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And which is a real tragedy, but they were apparently very close during mm-hmm. this process of putting the lectures in kind of chapter form defining them into kind of one subject. Mm-hmm.
But this talk actually is unedited, just transcription of an audio talk, of which we have thousands probably. So this is his actual Suzuki Roshi, unedited in this case.
no intrusion by Trudy.
Yeah. He says, to take refuge in Buddha means to become one with Buddha, or to find our true nature, which is not different from Buddha. And then he says, Buddha himself experienced it, and Buddha has the same nature that we have. This means it is possible to have the same experience as Buddha, because we share the same nature. And then he qualifies this. Maybe he was used to doing this because in 1967, early years of Zen Center, I think that many of his students were wholeheartedly throwing themselves into Zen practice, looking for the special experience, right? So he says, Suzuki Roshi says, because we have the same nature, it means it's possible to have the same experience as Buddha. And then he immediately maybe catches himself and says, this is not some particular experience when we realize our true nature on some occasion. That's and a little bit like Trudy maybe would have edited that. Like, they sound contradictory in a way. So we never know exactly what he meant, but that kind of caught me. He's saying, we can have this experience as Buddha. And then he says, but it's not some particular experience.
Yeah. It's just like Dogen.
Yeah, a little bit like Dogen. Yeah.
Maybe it's not nothing special.
Yeah, nothing special. Or I hear it like also maybe a really deeply pervading our experience, not in some momentary way, but more like Dogen himself says, I'm not sure if it's in regards to the word enlightenment or awakening, but maybe it's just about practicing the Buddha way. Dogen says it's like walking in the mist, and as you're walking, you're gradually getting more and more damp, yes. But you don't really notice it happening till you're like completely soaked, and wow, I'm like drenched, but it wasn't like a big downpour all at once. Maybe Rinzai Zen is like a big downpour, like you really notice. You were totally dry and now you're totally wet. Yeah. But Soto Zen, at least in this example, is like this gradually permeating our being. So we really do get just as wet as a downpour, but I hardly notice it happening.
Is that the difference between the gradual and the sudden school kind of thing?
Yeah, so we could say.
Sometimes Rinzai are sometimes called by those short terms, if you will.
Yeah, and I have heard that too, that Soto and Rinzai sometimes get put into this sudden and gradual, and I don't know exactly where that came from, because more like traditionally it's said that all of Zen after the sixth ancestor is called the sudden school. In early Chinese Zen, particularly with that story of the poems about polishing the mirror to wipe it free from dust, and the northern school of Zen was based on this poem about you got to constantly wipe the mind mirror clean so no dust lands on it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a gradual process of polishing, right? Whereas Huineng, the sixth ancestor, said there is no place for the dust to land, and there's no dust actually either. So that's truly the sudden school. Total emptiness teaching is the, there's not even, once we realize that point, there's nothing to do. And then Soto and Rinzai both developed out of that Six Ancestors Southern School. So maybe in terms of their approaches of like pushing for a kind of sudden breakthrough, maybe we'd say Rinzai Zen has the sudden orientation, but I think Soto Zen includes that in the way that there's nothing other than this moment, we might say.
Doesn't one of the poems talk about sudden and gradual?
Yes,
the harmony of different.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Referring, and that poem came like just a couple of generations after the Sixth Ancestor, so it was kind of like referring to the to that story of the mirror polishing stories and the branching there into the sudden and gradual. But it's kind of celebrating that in the way there are no southern or northern ancestors, and people's faculties may be keen or dull, but it doesn't matter in the way, and sudden and gradual arise. Also in Jewel Mirror Samadhi, talks about sudden and gradual.
Like different sides of the
coin. Yeah, different sides of a coin, not really different. So, Suzuki Roshi says, when we become one with Buddha or truth, he also defines Buddha as truth, there is no communion or interrelationship because it is just one. This is completely taking refuge in its true sense. And it's a part in this talk where he's bringing up this Kano Doko, this communion between Buddhas and sentient beings, and which we looked at earlier in this essay, where Dogen says taking refuge happens in this mystical communion between Buddhas and sentient beings, or in this sympathetic resonance. Or Suzuki Roshi translates this term Kano Doko as responsive communion between Buddhas and sentient beings. And so Suzuki Roshi talks about that too. But then I thought this was interesting that he says, that's how refuge in Buddha arises, in this us as a limited sentient being that we feel as if we're separate. We, from our humble, small place as a sentient being, take refuge in the vastness of Buddha. And in that meeting of who I think I am and Buddha beyond who I think I am, in that meeting, refuge in Buddha happens. But then Suzuki Roshi says, when we actually become one with Buddha, which is when refuge has happened, we could say, when refuge actually has happened, we're now one with Buddha, and in that case, there's no more communion or interrelationship anymore, because it's just one. So you could say, when refuge has actually happened, us as the sentient being separate from Buddha, we dissolve into each other. We are just one, right? That's oneness means there's no relationship anymore, right? Oneness means no relationship with anything, right? Because there's nothing other than the one to be related to, right? So I thought it was just a nice twist on that. When we actually do become one with Buddha, there's no more communion. Before we become one with Buddha, then there's this we can long to meet Buddha, and then Buddha meets us. There's still a separation there. There's not oneness yet. But when actually we become one with Buddha, then there's no more mystical communion, no more relationship. There's just one reality. And plain and simple, doesn't have to be like, then it's just a ball of light or something. It could be like, just like this. Oneness, where we're actually not related to each other in the deepest possible sense, because we're too intimate to be related.
Is that why in the mountains, a wise man never meets another? There's only activity of the mountains. Is that what he's talking about?
Oh, is that Mountains and Rivers Sutra?
Yeah, he said, like, mm-hmm. Dogen's like, in the mountains there are many sages mm-hmm. and wise people assembled. But then he's like, in the mountains a sage never meets another sage. There's only the activity of the mountain.
That sounds just right, yep. That sounds like the same point, yeah. I would say, without, you know, looking at the words exactly. Yeah. There's no meeting in oneness. I might say, but isn't that sad? Because we like to meet. But this is even more joyful than meeting, right? This is, and there still can then, we can still, in a way, maybe pretend to meet. We can still say.
That's through the appearance.
Yeah, the appearance. There's still the appearance. Like, hi, Stan, we can still talk, but actually, it's not really that we're two people talking with each other.
One with one. One voice voicing with one other.
Yeah, that appears as two people. Yeah.
If you're bored, you have to have imaginary friends.
Yeah. So maybe that's why Buddha created this mess. He got bored and wanted imaginary friends.
Touched with another being.
We won't get into that.
Not always so. His talk for Suzuki Roshi, he says he was flying across America and the sun was going down. And when you see that, you see the sun, you feel quite lonely, but you're always with everything, he said. And I think he said something like, you're always with everything. And he says something like, that's truer than I can say and truer than you can imagine.
Ah, nice. Yeah. He's truer than I can say and truer than you can imagine. That's Buddha. Yeah. So there's another way of talking about refuge. What is this refuge, which has this sense of like placing our trust and security in something, the place of safety? Well, another way of talking about it is this being one with. So I am one with Buddha. I am one with Dharma. When there's no separate Dharma as an idea outside of me, I am one with Sangha. I'll take on refuge.
Even though this body is going to die?
Even though this body is going to die?
I don't know.
It's food as a refuge?
Well, it's like taking security. Well, you said taking security, but it's like, this is a super insecure
world that we live in. Exactly.
It's like, take security in insecurity, because there's like a deeper security.
Well, yeah, we've talked about this in previous weeks, that Buddha, as our true nature, and we could even say the oneness of everything, could say, is totally secure. You're right, this body is just going to die. So anything in this life that's coming and going is not a supreme refuge, but the oneness of everything, we could say, is not coming and going. Mm-hmm. There's coming and going within the oneness.
But then there, like Hakuin says, that there's no ice without water and there are no Buddhas without sentient beings.
Yeah, so that's why we can take as sentient beings, we can take refuge in Buddha.
But Buddha doesn't exist without sentient beings.
Well, because we need him. I mean, and that's probably another, just a manifestation of the love inherent in the universe. That it takes Buddhas and saints and all the other to help us find a deeper connection with each other and ourselves.
We could also say the oneness of everything needs everything, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of like there's the oneness that appears as the differentiated everything, but there is no, we can't even speak of oneness if there's not everything to be one. So that's a little bit like if Buddha is the oneness, Buddha depends on the multiplicity of sentient beings to be one body of sentient beings. Otherwise, there's no, we say that you can't, in other words, you can't really have oneness without multiplicity. You could say it like that.
When I was younger, there was a good book about impermanence, and there was Alan Watts, it was Wisdom of Insecurity. It's a really good book. It's just a thin book that talks about what you were talking about, Emily. the permanence of that we're going to die and that kind of thing. So I found it very helpful at that time. Kind of rest the wisdom of insecurity. So it's just the idea of resting in the idea that everything is impermanent. The way the way he speaks and the way he talks about it is really quite helpful.
Yeah, and here it's kind of like the traditional way of talking about refuge in Buddha is it's like that which is not impermanent. That which is not impermanent. Buddha doesn't come and go. Buddha nature as, unchanging, empty awareness or the totality of everything is actually that it in itself doesn't come and go. So therefore, it's a supreme refuge because everything that's coming and going is unstable and changing and unreliable.
I think before I understood that, though, at that time, it was more about just the idea of being able to rest in like chaos, being able to rest in the fact that this is what's happening. Accepting, I guess, is really
accepting impermanence.
Yeah, just accepting what's going on, not sort of trying to manipulate it.
And maybe accepting impermanence. Accepting impermanence is maybe close to opening to that which is not impermanent. They're closely related. Because we're usually taking refuge in particular things that are impermanent. Like, possessions and relationships and, our body and mind. All of these things. When we're more like accepting that all those things are changing, then we're actually opening to that which is not changing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It feels like in a way we have to get to that point first, realizing that things we thought were reliable in that moment, get to that sort of thing, and then from there we go like, oh, but actually it's all reliable in a different way. We have to sort of like go through that sequence.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Seems to me. I don't know if we have to, but that seems to be the normal path.
Actually
believe everything's going to last, and then they realize it's not, and then that opens them up.
That was my understanding. That's how it worked for me.
We become disillusioned by the impermanent things of the world. Or as like Nagarjuna says, without being grounded and stably accepting, we might say, of the conventional truth, which is the impermanence, impossible even, to realize the ultimate truth, which is not impermanent, the unchanging ultimate truth of emptiness. So, Dogen went through these different versions of three treasures, and then he just gets into this storytelling mood. Where he just brings up these classic Indian sutra stories that are, I think for us, kind of strange. They're very kind of like mythical. You can also just listen if you don't have one. So there was this one story about the dragons, maybe Nagas, suffering dragons, and the Buddha said, take refuge in the three treasures, and they did, and then they were able to have some understanding. And so now we're up to this next section of another dragon story. There was this blind female dragon, all kind of like sick and wounded and bleeding and oozing pus and just like very suffering. And I'm just paraphrasing here because we wouldn't have time to read it all. And it turned out that she was a nun in former life and had a hard time following the precepts, and because of this karma, fell into this dragon body, and And now she meets the Buddha in her dragon, suffering dragon body, and says, please help me. And the Buddha scooped up water with his hands and said, I call this wish-granting medicine. I will speak the truth to you. And he tells this little story to kind of prove that he's speaking the truth. He said, in a past life, I gave up my life in order to save a dove. This is about halfway down, page 3 here. I had no doubt and did not hold on to myself with the mind of self-clinging. If what I say to you is true, all your unwholesome sickness will be healed. It's kind of like this faith-healing kind of story, and kind of like to prove the sincerity, that it kind of has this magical quality too, that I'm able to do this healing because I've just practiced selflessness in these extensive ways for a long time. And that by the power of the truth and this virtue, I'll be able to heal you. And then the world underworld put the water in his mouth and sprayed it over the blind dragon's body. Instantly, all her sickness was healed, cured. And the dragon said to the Buddha, wow, well, now I want to take refuge in the three treasures, or receive the three treasures from you.
What an incentive.
Yeah, so it's kind of like we might say, maybe this points to the Buddha didn't say, well, you should just take refuge in the three treasures, you sick, suffering dragon. He said, first I'm going to actually heal your wounds. And then when she was kind of restored to a healthy dragon, then she was like, both, I guess, had strong faith in Buddha as a healer, but also was maybe ready for the next step. So I think it's a nice example of, like, it's nice to go actually, like, cook food for the for Food Now Bombs and the homeless community, instead of just saying, y'all, people should take refuge in the three treasures, and then you'd be so happy. Said, just feed them, just take care of them, help them become healthy. And then, maybe, when they're really healthy and they're not worrying about their survival and their health so much, then they would be like, well, for one thing, they might realize, well, I'm still not totally satisfied. Now I'm like totally healthy, strong and ready to go, but actually, I'm still suffering. I need to take refuge. It could be part of the story too. But it's a nice example here of the Buddha doesn't go right to refuge. First, let's work on the basics.
It's like Maslow's pyramid.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. We need our, like physical survival needs met before spiritual needs. Or he calls self-actualization, right? Maslow. So the world-honored one did confer the three refuges upon her. Dogen says, recaps the story. This dragon had been a nun in the Dharma of Vibhashin Buddha. That's Vibhashi Butsu Daiyosho. So this past eon Buddha. Although she'd broken the precepts, she was familiar with Buddha Dharma. Seeing Shakyamuni Buddha in person, she asked him and took refuge in the three treasures. This is certainly nurturing the wholesome root. So maybe we hear these stories and they, in our storehouse consciousness, they're now stored away along with billions and billions of other stories in our, ongoing storehouse, so that maybe in some future life, somebody that is related to us right now will be like a totally suffering dragon or some other being. But because of these like seeds that were planted in this life of hearing of the three treasures, maybe it has those, that enables us to then ask in the future, I want to take refuge in Buddha again. Maybe it won't even be in the English language. It might not even be what we call Buddhism. But it might be those same seeds that we're trying to cultivate in this life, even when we're in a horrible state in the future, it's like this dragon had taken refuge in Buddha, right, in eons ago. And because she remembered that somewhere back in the recesses of the storehouse consciousness, maybe she was able to then say again, now I'm healed from this dragon sickness, and I want to take refuge again. For her, it probably felt like the first time. And for us, in this life, we take refuge and receive the precepts. We might feel like, wow, it's something totally new. But maybe we've done this many, many times. Or not we, exactly, right? But this has happened in connection with who we are now. Many times. So Dogen says, the benefaction, the merit and virtue of seeing Buddha undoubtedly depends on taking refuge in the three treasures. Even though you're not a blind dragon and do not have an animal body, if you've not encountered the Tathagata and taken refuge in the three treasures, you're far away from seeing Buddha. You should be pitied. The world-honored one himself gives refuge in the three treasures. Know that this merit is both profound and immeasurable, the merit of taking refuge. So, it's like classic old-time religion. Dogen saying, I think when we hear these things, I feel like we have to keep translating them in our mind into, well, what does this mean? Is it just like, you have to do the Buddhism thing? I don't think it's so much that as like, what's the principle behind this? It means like, be one with everything if we want to be free from suffering. But, you know, the traditional way of talking about that is these three treasures. And so then there's another story from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. When the Buddha was in the Nigrodha grove in Kapilavastu, Mahanama of the Shakya clan came to him and said, what is a lay person, an upasaka in Sanskrit? You know, we have bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, and upasikas is the Sanskrit name for a lay follower of Buddha. And pretty sure that the name upasika is the feminine form, means literally something like drawing near, coming close. So literally like the lay followers, the non-monastic followers of the Buddha were like coming close, drawing near, we could say, to the monastic Sangha and to the Buddha. So like staying close is a kind of interesting etymology for the Buddha's lay community. So it says, so Mahanama, the lay person, Mahanama said and came and said, what's an upasaka, a lay person? And the Buddha said, if a good man or good woman whose senses are open or whose faculties are sound is really, I think, in their right mind, take refuge in the three treasures, this person is called an upasaka or a lay person. And we still have that form in our Jukai ceremony. You become a upasaka, actually, in the Jukai ceremony, taking refuge in the three treasures. But if you do it kind of like totally distracted, you're in the ceremony with your iPod on, like listening to music, and you're just watching the words, and yeah, yeah, yeah. Or you become like, you know, completely drunk or something, then it doesn't count. And I think this is because it's a nice instruction for the ceremony. You're soon going to do a Jukai ceremony.
Oh, not anytime soon.
Oh, no.
It's in process.
It's in process, yeah. Yeah. And Rachel, very soon, in just another like week or so, actually. So I think part of the what makes the ceremony work is when you're, especially that part of taking refuge in the three treasures, like you're really present and like really like you know, say it like you mean it. And because that's, there's power in that, right? You're not just mouthing the words, right? Right here in the fullness of this ceremonial occasion, I take refuge in Buddha. We feel the strength of that, I think, when we say it with sound faculties. So, interestingly, Mahanama says, what's a partial layperson? Or a one part layperson? Or another translation says, step by step layperson. And Buddha says, Mahanama, when one receives the three treasures and receives one precept of the five lay precepts, that person's a partial upasaka, partial lay person. And this is unusual. It's in the Mahayana Sutra here, but it's rarely heard of. I think I have heard that before in China. Maybe they do this too. We don't do this at Zen Center. We don't give the option. All precepts or nothing. But I think in the Chinese tradition, you can take some precepts, receive some. And I think it's particularly meant for, like, if you feel like, it's a little bit more, maybe more literal, like, actually, I don't think I can really follow that one, but I'd like to take some of them, the ones I really feel like I can follow. And they say, okay, you can do that. It's kind of skillful, maybe. And step by step would mean, like, you could eventually work up to receiving more of them. In our tradition, I think it's more like we just have this bodhisattva spirit of like, well, we might not be so great at all of these, but we want to be, and we want to keep studying and learning them, and their precepts are very kind of like open. We can look at them in different ways, and our understanding of them keeps evolving as we practice, I think, too. So it's not so like black and white. You know, I think some people,
an intention,
yeah, and maybe in the Buddhist time, but still like in the Theravada tradition, they take so literally. So it's like the intoxicants precept. I mean, you can never have like a sip of alcohol, and some people are like, I do like to have wine at dinner sometimes, not to get really drunk, but therefore I can't receive that precept literally, mm-hmm. But you know, we have a more broad understanding of the spirit behind it. So Dogen's just including this. And then Dogen's comment is, thus, in becoming a disciple of Buddha, you take refuge in the three treasures. Whatever precept you receive, you take refuge in the three treasures and then receive the other precepts. In this way, you receive the precepts as a result of taking refuge in the three treasures. And I've seen this in other commentaries studying these three refuges recently too, that that seems to be like a kind of standard thing, is you can't receive in the Buddha Dharma, you can't receive these ethical precepts before you take refuge in the three treasures as a kind of matter of course. I just saw, this is a made-up thing in America, at Great Vow Zen Monastery, they have this ceremony called, I can't remember what they call it, but it's, I think this is not something that happens in Japan. I think they have a regular jukai where you sow a rakasu and you receive the 16 bodhisattva precepts like we do. And that's kind of a bigger deal. It's like you're becoming a disciple of a teacher as a lay person at that point. But they have something before that that's just called the five precepts, and it's these early five, the first five of the bodhisattva. And they don't have refuge. I was just reading this recently. I thought, that's really, it kind of violates this traditional way where you always take refuge first, but they say it's for people who don't want to be Buddhist necessarily, but they want to commit to this ethical conduct in this basic way. I thought it was interesting.
That's kind of true for the Theravada school, where the Sila comes first, and that's the...
Well, they still, but in Theravada, though, they still do take refuge in Buddha, mm-hmm. first. Like, they have a lay precept ceremony with five precepts, but they always start with the three refuges, mm-hmm. like we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we say, well, is that just some technicality? They want to make sure that the ceremony is done right. But I think the principle behind it, I would understand, is that it puts the ethical precepts in this context of, like, it's not just ethical precepts. It, maybe this great vow version is meant to be, it's just ethical precepts, but in the traditional case, it's ethical precepts leading to awakening for the purpose of taking refuge in Buddha as the awakened one and all the Buddha's dharma, not just the ethics, but the whole dharma of practice and the sangha of the Buddha's followers or practitioners. So I think it's kind of nice that it's kind of like first you have the refuges, and then in a way the precepts are kind of like commentary on the refuges, or they're like footnotes to the refuges.
Yeah, it's the way the refuges come to life.
Yeah, the way refuges come to life. Yes. Or we might say, well, how do... Okay, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Well, how do I do that now? Well, here's these precepts. This is one of the main ways you can take refuge, practically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... So Dogen mentions that.
Why would you want to do the precepts if you didn't have a refuge? Behind it,
yeah. Well, I think
it's
in this.
To me. It seems like you have to have that.
Mm-hmm. If it's in a larger Dharma context, I think that's true. But maybe this point of this great vow ceremony was like people who are interested in Zazen, say, but the whole, you know, package of Buddha Dharma, all these teachings leading to awakening. They might be like, I don't even really understand that so much. I like sitting and relaxing my mind, and I really want to live in a harmless way in the world, but the Buddhism package, I'm not quite ready. And it's, I think in their version it almost implies eventually maybe people do get ready. It's almost like a step. You do the precepts first and then you do the 16, which includes more later. Yeah.
I think it's kind of nice. It kind of feels like maybe that's quite a skillful thing for America.
Yeah.
So many people feel kind of burned by their religion.
Yes.
They're reluctant, resistant to any other one.
Mm-hmm. That might be a big part of it. Yeah. Uniquely American thing for people burned by religion. I think they would probably say that's why we came up with it. Yeah.
It sounds like a patriarchy that we're modifying now, but like, it's like, why would I want to join this like list of men that have been excluded from for like thousands of years?
Yeah, there's some stuff like that.
A little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there was, I don't know, now women are in the lineage.
It's changing here.
But I can imagine that places like San Francisco that might offer, you know, beginners to practice like a 6-week beginning class on, you know, just like an extended Zazen instruction the way we do here. And that at the end of that, they might offer such a ceremony.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you've been coming now for 6 weeks and you've expressed some interest and why don't you try on these ethical precepts?
And I think that they do have in their great vow, in their little brochures, they have a little course of, some basic, maybe a meeting with the teacher some, and you come to us like a course like that, I think. And you sew at Wagesa, there's like kind of, it's like a strip. It's like strap. It's like a rakasu without the rakasu. Yeah, it's like just a strap. So you do actually make something, but it's very simple. And then for Jukai, they sew a rakasu. So, and then for priest ordination, you sew more. So each step, you're doing more. And they also have, there's more study and other things for each step.
At Shasta Abbey, they sew the...
Yeah.
What's it called?
Wagesa.
Wagesa.
So I think it's the same gesa as okesa.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what wa means. So, according to the Dharmapada, the Sanskrit version of the Dhammapada, long ago, there's another magical Indian story of beings in other realms. long ago Indra, so Indra is the lord of the gods, say, like in the Deva realm, kind of a, there might be multiple Indras, but maybe at any one time there's only one Indra. But in this high celestial realm, with very long life, right? Long ago Indra knew that he was about to die, maybe part of the celestial powers of devas is they kind of know when they're about to die and know where they're going to go. So Indra knew he was about to die and be reborn as a donkey. He was worried and thought the Buddha, the world-honored one, alone could save him from his trouble. And you might wonder, actually, because even the Buddha says, everyone has their karma. The Buddha can't, like, undo your karma. If your karma, which is the cause and effect of your actions, are going to lead you to the donkey realm, then the Buddha can't, like, actually undo that. I mean, Buddha does teach that. But still, Indra thought, well, but the Buddha is enlightened and can help, probably, in some way here. I take refuge in Buddha, right? So Indra went to the Buddha, prostrated, and took refuge in him. Took refuge in Buddha. His life then ended before he stood up from the prostrations. It was like quick timing with this one, right? Okay, I gotta find the Buddha. There he is, Buddha, I take refuge in you. Punk! And like, maybe had a, when he bowed, he had a heart attack. Like, didn't arise from his prostration. Yeah, I know. But it counted. It was enough of a prostration. I guess you could say the lowering part of the prostration is more important than coming back up. So he fell before the Buddha and took refuge in Buddha and died immediately. And just as expected, he entered a donkey's womb. So, these rebirth stories, right, say that there's no rebirth in Buddhism. It's surely in these stories.
Is this the story from the Dhammapada?
Dhammapada, yeah. But, you know, it must be a Sanskrit version of the Dhammapada. Because I don't think, yeah. I think there are later versions that are have commentaries on, so it's probably like the same sections, but like expanded stories that bring out. Maybe there's a section in the Dhammapada we read earlier on refuge, so it might be like a story elucidating refuge. This is kind of a fun story, actually. Interesting and surprising one, I thought. So he enters the donkey's womb, right? But then the donkey broke her bit, the mother donkey, right? Who Indra is now in this, like, the embryo, just conceived, right after mating. So this donkey then broke her bit, went into a potter's house full of, like, you know, ceramics, and destroyed many, like, wandered around and knocked all the pots off the wall. And getting angry, the potter hit the donkey and harmed her womb. And at that moment, Indra, who had only been there maybe like 5 minutes in this embryo, regained his life as Indra.
Wow,
yeah. What a story.
Soon we made a movie.
Yeah. So, far out, huh? So you could say, like, maybe according to the laws of karma and rebirth here, not exactly went back to the same Indra. I would understand it would be like, was basically died. That was a 5 minute actual life in this embryo, you know, fertilized egg, which is maybe also points to the fact that there's a sentient being at the moment of conception, according to Buddhism, for discussions about abortion and so on. Let's not go there. But, or maybe not in this, we could say if it returned to the same life as Indra, then maybe it wasn't actually quite a separate life yet, it was just in the process. But whether it was a new Indra, at any rate, it's interesting that almost like the Buddha couldn't prevent, this is how I hear it, the Buddha couldn't prevent this birth as a donkey, but the Buddha could maybe like change the conditions, maybe like, maybe the Buddha made like a, a wind blow through the town, so the donkey got restless and went into the shop and knocked everything apart. So I don't think the Buddha made the donkey do it, walk into the shop, or made the potter hit the donkey, but maybe shifted something slightly. But the interesting thing is, it wasn't exactly like the donkey that got hit. We could hear it as it wasn't really a violent thing. The donkey didn't even know she was carrying this new potential donkey, right? It's more like it just was enough to damage the embryo for this rebirth. So you could hear the whole thing as kind of like, even though it sounds kind of violent, there's hitting involved and stuff, but maybe it's just like with a skillful means to keep Indra from, because Indra took refuge in Buddha, was not reborn as a donkey. Yeah.
So my thought was that after that prostration, then his mind was more calm. So like in the Tibetan idea of you choose your birth based on your state of mind, his mind was more calm, so he somehow chose a donkey that was
about to,
knowing, there was something in that choosing.
Yes.
So it was.
Yeah, nice. I like that. Yep. Yep. And I think even though we could get all into the metaphysics of rebirth and so on, still, I think just if we hear all of these kind of stories, including rebirth stories, as all just about this very subtle workings of intentionality. And because this is what karma basically is intention. So there was some, kind of openness to something happening differently from this refuge. If it was a sincere refuge in a more vast perspective, we might say, then, it's not like, well, oh well, now we're gonna have to go through, 30 years as a donkey, it's gonna be like this. It's more like, maybe this situation is more flexible than I just thought.
Maybe that's the point of the story.
Yeah, maybe the point of the story. I think so. Or we're not sure. It's a weird story.
I suppose, like, reading these, maybe if I knew that, because I know they're from Dogen, and I sort of have this idea of Dogen as this quite strict person, like quite prescriptive about, I've forgotten the correct term, the verse that we read about, when you're going to meditate, you put your mat down, you put it down this way.
Yes.
Sort of thing. So he's very
direct foot on your left.
Then all the different pieces, all the form and everything like that. You think of this person who's quite strict and quite disciplined, and also he can write amazing, like the Genjo Khan and everything like this. So you sort of go, wow. And then the thing that always strikes me is, when he puts these stories in, they're really saying, like, you don't have to aspire to this great thing, even though you might get that. I pick it up from reading it. It's just all you have to do is faith and keep the sincerity sort of thing. So that's the thing that strikes me the most, even though, like, for me, being in the 21st century in the Western world, it's a fairy tale sort of thing, but the fact that he's said it as if to say, yes, it's possible right now. I can feel his compassion saying, it's okay.
Yeah, very much about faith, I think. And also this was written like in the last years, maybe the very last year of Dogen's life. And it seems like in these last couple of years of Dogen's life, his style changed. He became more, very, very traditional in this kind of way, less kind of like the Genjo Koan was like in his very first teaching, twenty something years earlier.
Is this unedited?
Unedited because he died before he could
edit
it. So he might have done more commentary. But in a way you could say his style was less dynamic than his earlier years. But there's a bunch of modern scholars now have these debates about why Dogen changed. Some even say that he was becoming senile. But he was only 53 years old when he died. But that's not a very nice story. I think another way I could imagine it is he knew that he was maybe not going to live long, and he wanted to really strongly establish the Sangha and maybe particularly the sangha of monks that were really going to carry on the practice for future generations, and actually did do that. So he, you know, instead of this kind of more like very broad kind of like, this is for everyone, of course it was, but his emphasis was later on like, you people, you small group of people with me, you gotta be really committed to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. He started talking about the precepts more at the end of his life. He started getting into all these ritual practices that's gonna like, way the tradition will get carried on. So, that could be part of it too.
Like, what did the dude do to, like, turn into a fox, or, like, you know, had a hard time following the precepts, and now you're pussing?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. You know, you can give us the precepts in this really cushy way, like, well, you know,
do your best.
5 minutes in a mule's womb.
Yeah.
But it's like, they're actually very precise.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The Buddhist ethics book, they're like, a zygote, a fertilized egg, is a precious human life.
Mm.
Our idea, yeah, killing that somewhere between like a chimp and a baby, you know, they're like very like super specific and like,
yeah,
harsh. I don't know,
kind of fire and brimstone,
yeah,
kind of a little. Dogen sometimes gets that way.
We don't know all the causes and conditions that caused him to become a donkey, for instance. There may be more out there that he's mentioned,
yeah,
well, but like for specific acts, it's, yeah, like, what was the fox guy? What did he do? They're like, he did this, and therefore...
He answered a question. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was before Dogen. That was in China, before Dogen.
Oh, okay.
That story, yeah. But yeah, that, I think that story is a lot like... And Dogen quotes that again in one of these later essays called Deep Faith in Cause and Effect. Is all about that fox koan. And Dogen is... yeah, I think really into the very minute particularities of cause and effect playing out in the world. Every action is really important, what we do. And at the same time, in the ultimate sense, everything is vast emptiness and just one bright pearl at the same time. So I think it's a nice balance of like the ultimate vastness, totally inconceivable, but the way it appears in the world, we totally take care of every little detail. I think Dogen had that nice balance. In the Tibetan tradition, it's sometimes said, one of the great teachers said, my view is higher than the sky, but my conduct is finer than barley flour. So kind of like the view of the ultimate truth is so high, it's beyond comprehension. But the way it appears, the conduct in the world is so fine and detailed. In Zen we say, Nemitsu no kafu, right? Is the intimate attention to every single detail, is the style of Soto Zen in particular. So like the way you hold a teacup and all of these things, even though it's all just one inconceivable atmosphere where everything is totally equal, we take care of it carefully. Yeah. So the donkey, so was, Indra was in the donkey's womb for a few minutes, then regained his life as Indra, and the Buddha said, your sins have ended as you took refuge in the three treasures at the end of your life. Hearing this, Indra attained the first fruit, becoming a stream enterer. So maybe it is actually the karmic effect, not so much that Buddha rescued Indra, but the taking refuge at that very last moment was like a very open mind, was the refuge, and that actually ended the particular cycle of cause and effect, or that this was going to be 20 years in a donkey womb. But that shifted because of this refuge. So you could say it's like the karmic effect. It's not that refuge undoes other karma, but refuge creates a new karma that is now in the mix with the other karma.
Yeah.
Hi, Rachel. We're hearing about Indras being born in donkey wombs and things like that.
What are your thoughts?
I didn't quite understand what you said.
That's okay.
Your sex.
I don't discriminate.
So Dogen just kind of reiterates in his comments here. So skip down a little bit. And there's another story, final story. In the Unprecedented Causation Sutra, the Buddha said, I recall that innumerable kalpas ago, in a mountain in the great country of Vimana, there was a wild fox, this is a different fox, chased by a hungry lion. While running, the fox fell into a well and could not get out. After 3 days, when it was ready to die, it opened its mind and said in a verse, due to misfortune, I suffer today and am about to die inside this well, it said in fox language. All things are impermanent. It would have been better if I had been eaten by the lion, maybe because now I have this slow, withering death, and I could have at least been some good food for the lion. Now I'm kind of useless. And he said, I take refuge in the Buddhas of the 10 directions. Please know that my mind is selfless and pure. Namu kie jipo butsu. Homage to and take refuge in the 10 directions Buddhas. When Indra heard the fox calling out the Buddha's name, he was shocked, thought of ancient Buddhas, and said to himself, I am on my own without a teacher, immersed in the 5 desires and drowning in them. So now this is Indra, this maybe the same Indra, who temporarily had a little donkey journey, is now like can hear with his celestial deva ear this fox calling the Buddha's name, and kind of remembers Buddha. But and says, I up here in heaven am drowning in the desire actually. And I just heard the name Buddha, and it reminded me that actually, remember, like several thousand years ago, I took refuge in Buddha. I almost forgot about that. Actually, Buddha really helped me out when I was in a bind. But that was thousands of years ago now. Maybe this fox is reminding him. So he flew down from the celestial realm together with 80,000 devas to talk with the fox. Seeing the fox unsuccessfully trying to climb out of the well, Indra inquired, does a sage not have skillful means? I see a fox, but you must be a bodhisattva with something valuable to teach. Would you please expound essential dharma for us devas? So maybe a little bit like, because he heard the fox talking about Buddha, he felt like, well, maybe you must be a special fox if you're taking refuge in Buddha. So can we hang out here up on the top of the well and listen to you expound dharma? It's a little bit rude, right? The fox is starving in the well. So the fox looked up and said, you are the king of devas, but you don't behave well. The dharma teacher is down here in the well, and you're up there. You're asking for essential dharma without expressing respect. You know, in the ancient teachings, they say that dharma should always be taught from a higher seat than the assembly. And it's reversed here. So like, we shouldn't, even in the, I always thought it was interesting too, in the monastic precepts, there's precepts for the monks to not teach if they're like in a lower place. And I thought, wouldn't that make them more arrogant? Shouldn't they be happy to take the low seat? But the precepts actually say, this is pre-Mahayana, too. But I say, if you're basically the people that you're talking to are not being respectful, you shouldn't teach them. Like, that's the meaning of these precepts. And there's a whole bunch of them. Like, if they're carrying a gun, don't teach them. If they're carrying an umbrella when it's raining, but you're not, don't teach them. Like, they should carry it over you. So I always thought that was curious. There's all these things that you would think would sound like they're give the monks higher status, but in fact, I think it's setting up this relationship of respectfulness around the Dharma teaching. But it's a tricky issue, these things. And they still, these precepts exist in countries other than Japan. So the fox is kind of bringing out that point. Well, you're up there and I'm down here, and if you want me to teach you, and I'm also starving, by the way. He doesn't say that. Why do you proudly regard yourself as, the fox says, you're not expressing respect. The Dharma water is pure and capable of saving all beings. Why do you proudly regard yourself as higher? And hearing this, Indra, the god, was ashamed. And the accompanying devas, the 80,000 in his retinue, were surprised and laughed at him and said, the king of the devas came down here and is not going to get any dharma. And Indra said to them, don't be so surprised. I have been stubborn and without virtue. I need to ask about the essential dharma. So he kind of was very humble. Indra said, it's okay you laugh at me. I should humble myself if I want to receive dharma. Then he hung his celestial robe down in the well. The fox grabbed on and he pulled him out. And then the devas prepared the sweet dew, the amrita, the food of the gods, for the fox, who took it and regained vitality. Like when Popeye pours the spinach. That's really amrita. So he was then all nourished again, and unexpectedly meeting good fortune in the midst of calamity, the fox rejoiced immeasurably and expounded essential dharma for Indra and the devas. Dogen says, this is called the story of Indra taking an animal as a teacher. In this way, we clearly learn that the names of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are rarely heard. Thus, Indra took the fox as his teacher. So maybe the point is that Indra, for thousands of years, hadn't heard of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but he heard, I take refuge in Buddha from a fox, for some reason. And, well, Buddha, this reminder of our true nature can come through this fox. You know, that's the power of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Funny stories. They clearly learn that the names of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are rarely heard. So when we hear them, maybe the point also is, if we hear a Buddha, it is so precious that even if it's some fox in a well reminding us of it, that we can, let's humble ourselves and receive Buddha, however it comes.
Maybe that's instruction can come from any quarter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, can we be ready for it? Yeah, and Buddha can teach through any form.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to be that ready sometimes. We're expecting it in certain forms. So then Dogen says, to conclude, with the help of our wholesome deeds and past lives, we have a chance day and night to encounter and hear the names of the three treasures and the Dharma left by the Tathagata. Such an opportunity does not recede in the course of time. This is the essential Dharma. We'll always have the opportunity to encounter the three treasures with the help of good karma, you know, benefiting others and not harming others. Even the demon Papimant, which is another name for Mara, one of Mara's many names. So even Mara takes refuge in the three treasures and escapes disaster. How much more so will others who arouse effort and accumulate merit by taking refuge in the three treasures. In the practice of the way by children of the Buddha, or disciples of Buddha, people always pay respect to and invoke the three treasures in the 10 directions, burn incense, sprinkle flowers, and engage in various practices. So, I think from ancient times, from Buddhist times, people have taken refuge, they've burned incense for Buddha, offered flowers to Buddha, and engaged in the practices of Buddha. This is an ancient path and the authentic practice of Buddha ancestors. Or authentic practice is literally kogi. So ancient, it's an ancient ceremony. This is an ancient path and an ancient ceremony of Buddhas and ancestors. This taking refuge in Buddha and burning incense and sprinkling flowers. Know that any practice that does not depend on the ceremony of taking refuge in the three treasures is the way of outsiders or that of demons. Does not depend upon the manner or style of ceremony, the gi ki of taking refuge. The Dharma of Buddhas and ancestors always begins with the ceremony of taking refuge in the three treasures. This translation left out the ceremony part. It just says, begins with taking refuge in the three treasures. The Dharma of the Buddhas and ancestors, which is a way of talking about, whenever we hear Buddhas and ancestors, it's the Zen lineage. Buddhas and ancestors is one of those synonyms for the Zen lineage. Always begins with the ceremony of taking refuge in the three treasures. And then Ejo, Dogen's disciple, says, copying of this draft written by Dogen, my late master, was completed on the day of the summer practice period in the seventh year of 1255, so 2 years after Dogen died. Dogen could not make revised and final manuscripts. He would have made some additions and deletions in the process of editing. Since this is no longer possible, I have preserved his draft. Signed, Ejo. At Zenkoji, Good Light Temple. Which was maybe a sub-temple of Eheji or something nearby. So, there we have it. Dogen's take on the three refuges. And as usual, I always enjoy really looking into Dogen, but also really looking into these three treasures. It's such a common teaching that we recite every morning, and it's Buddha Dharma Sangha. It seems like one of those things you learn really early on in coming to practice. Yeah, we've got the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And then I myself often don't think about it that much. So this is really like, it's kind of re-inspired my heart to really see that as like the center of our whole practice. We could say many things are the center of our practice, but Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Keep remembering them. Ken or somebody mentioned in our earlier class, there's this story that Dogen, at the end of his life, maybe around the time of writing this, just before he was dying or as he was dying, there was a pillar in the room where he was trying to get well, and he wrote Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, tacked it on the pillar, and circumambulated the pillar as a ceremony of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I said, wouldn't he just be sitting zazen in his last hours? So he probably did that too. But something about expressing that devotion to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and reminding himself of it and walking around this center that actually can't be grasped, just walked around.
Is there any evidence of how he died? Like, when he died from? He was 53, which is probably old back then.
I think, I don't know if it was, it might have still been young even then. Anyone knows.
Yeah.
And, but it wasn't sudden. It was a long illness because he was at Eheji and sick for a while and then, taken to Kyoto, to a doctor and stayed in a lay disciple's house in Kyoto and actually died there in Kyoto. Yeah. Any final thoughts on the three treasures? Well, next class series in a few more weeks when practice period starts is in a way like part two, right? We have these 16 bodhisattva precepts and we start with the refuges, but then this next class series will be on the 10 major bodhisattva precepts, which are like the, as I like to think of sometimes, like the kind of commentary on or how you put the put refuge into practical effect in the world.
Is it 10 weeks for
a 6 weeks class? And that'll make for even, you know, there's more elaboration and all kinds of practical points come up around the actual precepts. So hopefully that'll be a fun discussion event. Thanks for coming and studying the great matter in this way. Oh, we dedicate any merit arising from our investigation and practice of the three treasures to all beings everywhere. May they open to the inconceivable merit and virtue of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.